Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
improving podcast technology while walking. Now, I think I'm in a unique situation. One is that I have to do a lot of walking just to, I suppose, part of you have to increase, do more, eat less to lose weight. So I'm doing that under government instruction. I have a government-paid coach to coach me to get down to my prescribed body mass index weight of 82 kilograms. I've started off at 97. I'm at 85 at the moment. And you just basically have to slog yourself and walk. There's another aspect in that better post-operative cognitive rehab if you, I suppose, get your brain active. And I suppose what happens if you sit down at a task, you lose, you know, last half an hour, then you feel a bit sleepy. If you're walking or doing some other activity, balancing or doing, you know, mixing cognitive and actual physical activity, you get a better put. And some people have listened to a few of these podcasts. There's 1,400. I do several podcasts a day. Now, the last ones, so this is as I've gone up under various technologies, slowly improving how I actually record the podcast and the technology to actually pump out the podcast. So yes, as it's been called, pumped out. They're not technically podcasts, they're voice memos, because I produce them and put them away. Now, I suppose the effect of a tragedy, not real tragedy, I have sort of a backup dictaphone, and I need the backup dictaphone because I was about to download two, 3 hours of podcasting, just dash it off, because I went for a 3 hour walk last night on this basically it's a road walk, but you sort of walk down the mountain across Australia's oldest bridge and then over to a spectacular sort of lost railway bridge, beautiful stone aqueduct in the middle of the bush. Okay, sort of one of the hidden secrets. You walk across that at night, walk back, and your informant has taken 3 hours. And I did 3 hours of podcasting. I put the podcast device down, and those people who know that, I can't find it. Not to worry. I thought, oh well, it really doesn't matter whether I broadcast or produce it. There were some aspects of it. I can do it a second time and I can improve things. Now, one of the things I did do is I went to a podcasting conference, and they pointed out the horror of doing what I do, and also the problem with microphone placement and stuff like that. And since then, I've sort of been aware of when there's big strong winds blowing, I'll have to do something about that. Unfortunately, at the moment, it's nice and still. I'm walking around, and I fiddled around with it a little bit and actually attached the microphone to my glasses. And also, what I'm also doing is, I don't podcast when there's a huge wind and it's going shh, you can't hear what's going on. I've actually got earphones on, so I can actually hear the level as I'm producing it. And so this is a general push, and this sort of really faces the problem of Australian researchers in general, that they have to really innovate out of the shed with no funding resource, because you find the there's a limited amount of funding, and the people who are great social climbers and give the gab, they can actually get the funding. So it means that the sort of the researchers with hearts have sort of two levels of funding problems. or getting equipment. One is that the, well, probably three levels. One is that there's not good equipment there to start off with. It's not a history, so it's rather a remote place, so there's not heaps and heaps of labs and markets and secondary things, you are very remote. So if you do order something, it takes a long, long time. Now this has really changed now with the advent of China. You can just order things which are pretty cheap. you're competing for a small pool of funding against some pretty savvy people who've just got that knack of grabbing that money. And so you may have something very good, and you can just lose out to it. And you know, there's special interest groups that people can basically have a little opening of their laboratory, or people can put it across. So what it winds out to is that you essentially are on your own wits to actually produce things. So about all this noise, I'm going to go for a few loops around the park today. And one of the things is that wearing the microphone where I do, I've got my reading glasses on, so I can't really see the people coming up, and it's probably not for a good walk in the bush. This one thing I'm going to have to do is put a speed on. Now they did show some high quality podcasting equipment that you can get, but that costs $200, and I'm in the realm of $10 and the such. Now on that, I'll just give the improvement of it. I'm sorry about all the traffic noise going through, and that will be a bit less as we come along. Now today has been just a real slog fest of sort of basic development. So you've got the podcast development, and what I'm doing is I'm building the Internet of Things beacon. So this a teacher sort of cast out of the other world into the dark underworld, buried alive, so to speak, forgotten, abandoned, and stuff like that. And I figured myself, dusted myself off, and said, "Well, how are we really going to teach this stuff? You know, what are we doing at the moment?" And we teach it in a very sort of like an artist building up layer upon layer of sketching and doing things like that. And we sort of approach education as an artwork, a building artwork. But students and experience, their experience is a revelation. And when they're on Revelation City, they just keep on going. And so if you can have a reaction, you show them in the thing, or they can have themselves, and everything is measured, it suddenly all comes together. So if the temperature is measured at certain degrees, if the mass is measured, the pH is measured, pH changes but doesn't increase uniformly, it increases in these steps as it goes through that sort of high level chemistry. That all happens there. You have the opportunity for, on one aspect, the low-ranking students, there's less to distract them. On the high-ranking students, they can soar. It's sort of like giving a student wings, this internet thing of, this internet of things, beaker. So this is a beaker where there's batteries and Wi-Fi and sensors, and it just sits there and it does everything. And and it's really interesting to see negative people sort of let them come along and they say, "Why do we need things? Why do we need things? We don't want that. We don't want like that." And they're just negative, 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 negative. And of course, it's a simple thing that in a room you'll have so many people who are outright negative, people who try and sense what's the what a group should do. There are people who are quiet. And then you have these dreamers who will attempt the impossible. They will, some will succeed and others won't succeed. And so I am attempting the impossible. And the reason I'm doing it basically is for fine motor skills of soldering things together, getting up to speed with various things, and basic problem solving and not losing things. You put your tools down and you have to speed and increase it, and there's the dexterity of soldering things. I'm still getting there, but incredibly, you basically have three hands to solder, the soldering iron has got this very heavy power cord to it, which is sort of a bit of a shit. So that's hard to do, so you've got to basically grab it and twist it and untwist it as you go. It'd be nice if a soldering tool had a rotary power feed into it. Then I would give anything for that. So anything which would reduce the weight of a soldering tool. In your hand you have to hold the circuit. Now, ideally people have little circuit holders and magnifying glasses to do these sorts of things, but sort of like if you're out in out in your back patio and stuff like that, you have your left hand turns into two hands. There's a forefinger and thumb, and the other fingers are going around maneuvering the solder into position and stuff like that to get going. But that being said, today has been a real crap day. So what I've done is the world has changed. So back in the even towards 2000, you would build something by ordering in capacitors, resistors, and chips and everything, and you put it on a prototype board and you put it all together. Now that's gone. And what's happened now is that you no longer buy a chip, you buy a board. A little board, but they're not big boards. They're the size of 5 cent coins, 20 cent coins, fractions of a credit card. And they've got pins on the outside, and they're programmable, they're A to D, they connect. And you have this problem of connecting these boards together. Or connecting a board, a little board, or taking the sensor and output a digital thing. To mention the weight of this, I have three load cells, and underneath each load cell, I have a little A to D converter that converts the analog of the load cell to a digital output. That's all beautiful, because you can actually put put all down. These load cells are rather sensitive, delicate beasties. So, I know from optoelectronics and stuff like that how to actually build a unit such you've got an optical unit which you can drop and all that type of stuff. So, I've built these little units, and it took a while to actually bind the unit together. So I got it together in little pieces, then to actually build it together. Eventually had to lash the A to D to the underneath of the board, or it's a little bit of Lego board, with some brass wire. Now, this thing which I've noticed a lot of time I tend to use is stuff that in the farm, when you're lashing something together, you get wire and you windlass it. And when you're putting up barbed wire and fortifications, you put some barbed wire, you put in your pickets, you bounce your concertina, I think it's called, a barbed wire up, and then you get some wire and you bind it up. So this binding thing has come across, works rather well. And where I've gone into is the micro USB folly. I can see it's micro USB bits, because micro, which is USB standard. So this is USB, which has been reimagined for a mobile phone, which is now slim. So they've got to come with something like that. So they came with a USB standard, which didn't survive, and it's USB B is sort of an intermediary thing, something which is destined for scrappy, to be replaced by USB C, which, you know, is basically not ingenious. It's just, here are the problems, here we have solved them with a bloody sledgehammer. So USB C, it's got more wires and it's reversible, but it's expensive. The USB B is only 10 cents a little receiver, female thing, 10, 20 cents. And so you can have, so if you have this, it means that you go USB to USB, it's now rock solid. That's how you connect up a mouse. It's the cables are designed for stability. So having the sensor and A to D and the USB port there, and of course I took a little bit of a shock, sort of basically I can't believe probably 2 hours to work out that the cords I have are not the USB micro USB cords, but they're just missing one of their 5 wires. And so in order to do this, you have to be a little bit clever on the way that you put the little female onto the board. The brilliant thing here is I can, I've got a microphone on, I can hear the slight wind as I'm coming along, but it's not that bad. Sorry about that wind. Before, I couldn't hear it, and of course, sometimes in the night, it's bloody, bloody cold to go across. Okay, getting back to this. I had arranged something which just spoke to me, is that I wanted my USB Bs in a tower, and using brass and soldering, I was able to build a little tower up. And of course, if it's in a tower, and you've got things above each other, you tend to wiggle it up and down, because wiggling it up and down puts enormous stress on it, and these little cheap 10 cent bits break apart. Okay. So, that was probably 11 o'clock before I had my break apart, and it's gone. So it had to be flat, and it had to be, it's broken, I have to make it incredibly strong. So I've got a little piece of brass, super glued three USB-Cs to it, and then got a brass wire over the top to act as the top support to it, so it wouldn't lift up. It was actually, the top was soldered flat down. And getting the last ports out, and so just organizing this over and over and over again. So I produced that, and then this new configuration was really not really sensible to have the temperature probe on them. So I put the temperature probe on the other side of the chip, and this is where I made a fatal error, because I sort of remembered that there was on the other side of the chip there's a serial output, which is sort of like the chip output of the USB output. So the USB is a serial output, so you can take the serial output directly off the chip, and that's important there. And then there's SPI, which is the protocol for reading the temperature. Made a very old prototype, but just waving to the cops as they're going past. Of course, now, say if I was out here with my hat on and I was carrying my weight, the cops would would know, they would stop me and say, how are you doing? What's going on here? And of course, when I was previously very ill, walking around, they used to keep a good old eye on me. So it's rather fun. Okay, getting back to it. So, now there's, what is it? Not many, out chips. There's actually only, 9 programmable serial outputs of it. And, what it does is it, there's actually not many outputs whatsoever from this, Feather Hazard. And, I can double them for you, but it costs twice as much, and just buy a second board and put it in there, and it, you know, just have 2 of them linked together. There's, you know, whatever. And so that's 6 for 3 load cells, and then one temperature cell, and you can probably get the pH meter in. So the dream of running a serial port bus from your central chip, your Wi-Fi chip, so your chip has got some Wi-Fi in it and some about 4 meg of programmable memory. So you can just have a little ball putting it together. The dream of basically having a mini computer with heaps of USB ports on it, and each USB port being a specialist sensor, is not going to happen, because the actual little ports that they put out are they're serial, but they're not bus serial. So they don't, there's 235 rather than 485. And so it's, I don't know what's happened. Now, of course, what has happened, obviously, is that you can buy this equipment really, really cheap, because what's happened is that China, I don't know what's happening. I'm sorry for the wind, I can hear the wind. Yeah, China is just producing this stuff, and when the market goes away, they drop the price, and then they stop producing it. But they don't seem to know that the market's going to drop away, and so you have these things, these sort of like old model cars going about the place. So you've got these things which have got a lot of potential, but a lot of problems in it. And of course, what I did was took this off and tested the temperature chip. Work well, then I re-put it on. Now, of course, I had misread the number of pins, and I actually put the temperature sensor down one set of pins going into the USB port. So that's a recipe for disaster. Because there's something else called a reset pin. You know, what the heck? You know, so they've got these other pins, and of course, what happened is that I was absolutely braining my board. The temperature probe was actually putting information into the USB port. So, like, go figure. And, of course, so what happened is that for some reason my chip would go off into la-la land and I couldn't communicate with it, and looked it up. And then I found, obviously, ways to overbrain it, an out-of-control chip. Which is, I suppose, some useful information that you really want to know. So, I don't know how this is happening, but I went back, and this is this entire time of burning things in, sort of taking them apart. And so you want to actually encourage your equipment to fail after just doing something. And so, and you don't want to do too many changes, because if you haven't really tested all the failures first, you can get it to fail when you've done something, but it's from several steps before, and it can really stuff you up. And of course, that's essentially what happened to me. And so I had to rebuild the interface, the plug interface for the load cells, three little load cells. Works really beautiful. It's fairly stable. And what happens is that if it's, you can plug in, plug out. If something's not working, you can pull out and plug across. So that's good. And I decided I could get bits of the web page going. Once I get it published to the web, it's all over Redgrover. The project's basically done itself. So I'm getting slowly there. When I got into the web page, the thing just went spastic. Sorry, I'm not allowed to say that anymore. It just went really bad. And had these began to lock itself up, a sort of a software lock, going, what the heck is going on? It's a, you know, there's, I've obviously called some libraries, and the libraries haven't known about each other, I thought, and so I then went for a little while, then commented out everything, and the problem seemed to be on every software code, even old software code. And then eventually I checked again that I understood it, and I sort of hadn't had really convinced myself that it was RxTx, which are the two serial outputs, then the SPI, and that's about it. On the far side, you got the power rail, power and control in one group, then the sort of communication group, which is SPI and serial, and on the opposite side you've got the sort of random array of GPIO. I don't know what general purpose input output, and that's broken into two groups. One is slave GPIO. This is everyday useful GPIO, and then the other one is, the other sort of top group is one reserved for motion control and things like that. So you've got those two groups come across. And so basically you've got only nine GPIOs and one analog pin just whacked in there. So it's like an Arduino, and really anemic Arduino, really small anemic Arduino. You know, the advantage is that it's small, it's got the sort of Wi-Fi and phone, the mobile, sorry, the battery power, so it's got everything together in a neat little board. So somehow they have sold this, and it's all right. Sort of, it's you're not going to convince anyone if you just rock up with your idea on an Arduino board. So you've got, to have this Wi-Fi altogether. But the while the serial is basically two dedicated lines, so basically it's a I suppose it's got about 12 outputs, one analog output, so it gives you 11, and then two for USB. And then that leaves you with, then you've got the rest there is your standard GPIO stuff. So it's just, it's really, you've only got nine outputs of this thing, which shouldn't be a problem, but if the technology you're going to isn't bust. So the problem was that it would read the temperature and feed it back into the USB and lock itself up. And this was a big thing. I couldn't diagnose it because it was just going off to behaving erratically and saying, I don't want to play. Oh, I've got a communication error. Of course, you people who say, oh, communication error, look at the communication ports. So I didn't quite do that, but I did learn how to brain the chip, and that is you ground. It says they want you to do it with a resistor, but I just grounded the pin 0, GPIO 0, and it resets. It said, all right, it's okay. And it took a while. And then I couldn't believe it, and so I checked and doubled, and then I saw that there was a reset serial and SPI, and so I had actually worked it out and then put it over, and then it says robust as anything. However, in the entire process, I have found improved my tinning and various things, so I suppose it's a good process, and basically if you're working hard enough, you can actually rather than discard your so there's a different process building up. So this is I don't know, it's sort of like a military invasion into if you go through concept prototype, research prototype, and various stages of production prototypes. And these are not clear stages. These are sort of a general thing, and you swap things out of your prototype, your concept prototype, until your research prototype begins to work. And you swap the little modules out of here. But what I'm trying to do here is... I suppose I'm going through the same process, but it's a little bit, it's more like hand-to-hand fighting, going through this, this stuff. And, I don't know, with all these projects, I'd say it's going to take so long, and then I remember back, oh, I just got that in the post this morning, and so this afternoon, I'm already along the way, but it's hard to say. It does all these things, a couple of days to really thrash and hold these things in your hand. So it took a while to actually work out how to get the female micro USB. It took a while to work out the case. It's hard to say. The problem is that it's not, you know, this idea of those three prototype stages and basically it's a tile, like you're flipping small sections of the project, flipping it forward, and there's no point going from concept prototype into production prototype in a section right away. You just want to get up to a research prototype, and the research prototype is different from your production prototype. Your research prototype has the flexibility to research it, to push up the power, to change the angles that you won't in your production prototype. You just want to make sure that capability is not there. But it's so this is clean. The problem here is that as you're going forward, looking at these different areas, you've got a fault, and basically, does that fault correspond to what you just did? And so the thing is that if you do something, you then have to really sort of drop it on the floor, smash it about the place, not quite like that, and try and look at it and say, in the production prototype, so in the production prototype, you already know, you're not going to re-engineer it all the time, so it's for production. But in the research prototype, you will build it together to be broken apart. So that's there. So this is finally there, and I don't know. I really feel that I need some help on the getting the web server. But once it's on the web, it's then downhill from there, because I've worked out how to avoid the call the handover. So basically LabVIEW's, it's, you know, dealing with the web server, you have to understand, are you well, how do you do, and stuff like that. So, so I prefer almost to get the data from one environment and pass it to another environment via a file. It's sort of like, you know, passing a report, here's your report, rather than, say, people in analysis having to speak with the actual, yes, you're in accident analysis or something like that, so you're going in to see how an accident happened, but it doesn't mean that you particularly are going to be very good at speaking to the accident victims, speaking to all the public. You're just looking at the high-level reports. I hope to get that through. And so the overall process is that I also hope that I'm giving good podcasts. Now, that being said, I'm going to try and reissue some of the podcasts which are lost and see if I can do it here and break into a different mode. I'm going at 36 minutes. Okay, thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.